It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. I called the panel this week a motley crew, but it really is a good one. Jeff Cannata is back to talk about E3. Brianna Wu, she's running for Congress in Massachusetts and is a game developer. And Dan Patterson from Tech Republic. We will talk about E3 and why Brianna says it was the best E3 in years. Some really interesting stories. Of course, AT&T's Time Warner merger is official. What that means for the internet and why security on cell phones in D.C. is so bad. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 671, recorded Sunday, June 17th, 2018. A bad day for the internet. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere using your smartphone or tablet. Go to texture.com/twit to start your free trial today. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a huge role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Moog Soft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Visit moogsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. And by LastPass. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week's tech news. And we have a motley crew this week because there was news in a lot of different arenas. But I'm really thrilled to bring them all together. Jeff Cannata, formerly President Cannata. We'll explain that in a moment. He's from DLC at 5x5 TV. And, of course, he's on Slash Film with Devendra. Hey, Jeff, great to see you.
Good to see you. I'm proud to be part of the Motley Crew.
Your Motley Crew. Today, you're Vince Neil.
I'll take it.
Well, because E3 was this week, and we thought we better get somebody who knows something about games in. Of course, I think Brianna Wu might know a little bit about games. She's a game designer, but more lately, a candidate for Congress in the 8th District of Massachusetts, Brianna Wu, 2018.com. Welcome back, Brianna. Great to see you.
Thank you for having me. It's always so good to talk about tech, like instead of depressing political situations. Yeah. So happy to be here today.
Also here, Dan Patterson from CBS Interactive. He's senior writer at Tech Republic. And there's a lot of other stuff, but we couldn't fit it in the lower third. So just there you have it right there. Dan, great to have you also. Dan is
great to be with you.
A leader in modern news gathering, I think is the best way to
that is too it. Kind.
Yeah, well, you've done some really interesting and I think important innovative stuff in news gathering, going back to your coverage of Occupy Wall Street and so forth. Although interestingly, you did that on Twitter, right? With and Storify, was it Storify you used?
Probably.
Doesn't even remember.
But Occupy was 2011, so
God, 7 years ago.
But
and we were just talking. You're kind of not a fan of the social media anymore.
I've always been a skeptic of social media. I mean, I was in the Twitter beta because I was a part of Odeo, and kind of saw it become our little open platform that Noah Glass promoted, and have watched and been a part of the rise of social media and in many ways benefited from it. But I got to tell you, long before the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke with Facebook, although I knew Alexander, he used to call me at weird times at the night and talk about all the, I covered Cambridge in 2016. And Alex would, I assume, be inebriated and call me at weird times of the night and rant about stuff. But I left Facebook a little under a year ago and Instagram because I just didn't like not only how it made me feel, and I don't want to get all emo on you, but it made me feel as kind of bad every time I logged in, and I didn't like my behavior on the platform. I mean, I mostly just spam work links on all social media. I just spam, here's a link that we're working on at Tech Republic or CBS News. And with Facebook, I felt like I was bragging a whole lot. And, you know, at least on Twitter, it's contextualized. Like, you really don't have to follow me, and I don't care if you don't want to follow me. And on Facebook, because it's a linear connection with people, I felt like maybe I was kind of being a dick to people who, you know, I don't want to show off or be abrasive in any way. I don't think I was, but I don't like any of the behavior. And I know Brianna experienced a lot of this. Jeff, I'm sure you've experienced a lot of this. Every time I'm on, I get, you know, 10 to 1 hate to anything positive. And I just think that
it does seem to bring out the worst in people, doesn't it?
Yeah, Facebook has isolated us. They've behaved in a way that maybe isn't intentionally malicious, but that has worked to alienate us. And I think that what they've done with gathering data on mobile phones has been insincere at best and malevolent at worst. And so I just felt creepy by the platform and left.
But you see what's happened? You have all this pent-up stuff that you haven't been able to express.
Right. I have no place.
That stuff should have been a tweet storm, man. I don't know. Wait a minute. I got to dig deeper, though. When you say Alexander used to call you drunk in the middle of the night, are you talking about Alexander Kogan, the Cambridge Analytica?
The former CEO of Cambridge.
Former CEO.
And I'm not saying he was drunk, but his behavior implied that perhaps he was inebriated sometimes, not all the time, sometimes.
Sounds like you're
but I'm not saying that he was, because I don't know that he was. But yeah, I covered Cambridge and had a mixed relationship with them in 2016. So I cover politics, and there just weren't a lot of people covering big data in politics. There certainly was Sasha Eisenberg in 2012. But in 2016, if you covered data and how data was driving the election, there wasn't a lot of competition. So sometimes I would write a story that Alex liked. Sometimes I'd write a story that he didn't like, and I would get an earful from him and other executives at the company.
Wow.
Sounds like somebody that's going to be a witness.
Yeah, no kidding.
Do you know what I found, Dan? Running for office, I was out the other day, and I was like, I was just thinking to myself how happy I felt. Just like deep joy inside. And I think a lot of that is the process of this makes you get off the computer, Twitter, off Facebook. And you spend so much of your day smiling at strangers, waving at everyone, even if you don't know them, trying to make friends everywhere you go. And I really feel like it makes you become a better person. It gets you away from that. Like, do you know the behavior on Twitter where it's like you get someone's tweet and you snark tweet it with the most cutting, sarcastic thing you could possibly say there? And I'm certainly guilty of that.
I don't, but I see it.
Yeah. I just think like it makes you feel better, or at least I feel better since.
So my question
doing
is,
this job.
My question about this is it a function of human beings being connected to one another that does this, or is it a function of these platforms? Because are we just incapable of as a species of being able to communicate globally all the time to everybody? Or is there something specific to the way these platforms handle that process that elicits this kind of behavior?
It's a great question, Jeff. I think that it is these platforms in particular, especially with algorithms that incentivize fast behavior and fast reactions, and the platform's design. So if you remember Facebook, you used to have to hit enter before responding to a comment. And I'm sure all of us with email are never like that. And email is certainly an example of a platform that connects everyone. MX records are something that is interpreted by every mail server in the world. And so we can connect with everyone. I believe that Facebook is engineered in such a way so that we get those dopamine pings with every notification, and we are incentivized to leave a very quick, fast response. I also think that the algorithm segments people, and I think that it plays to our worst nature. So there are ways that perhaps we could design platforms, and you guys might be the experts, Jeff and Brianna, especially with your expertise in gaming, on how to bring out the best in people. And I think that Facebook probably has followed the their own stock, and they've had to do things that set them above and beyond their competition. But in doing so, they behaved in a way and they built a platform in a way so that it brought out the worst in people.
As the old timer here, though, I am going to point out that I don't know of a single social network that hasn't done, I mean, start going back to the days of the news groups of Usenet, where right. Flame Wars eventually destroyed it. Then The Well, which I loved, that Flame Wars eventually made intolerable. Almost, it seems, and look at YouTube comments, look at any place you get a bunch of people together. It often starts out very pleasant, wonderful. It's a beautiful, warm bath of a human interaction. And then somehow, for some reason, it just degenerates. And it seems like that's just part of being a social network after some number of years.
Even email. I mean,
even email.
Were there no social networks, we would all still be getting those forwards that we survived.
Look at the garbage we get in email, right?
Yeah, true. True.
So maybe this is, I mean, I think you're right that algorithms exacerbate it, and Facebook's algorithm. And we were talking before the show, I don't think they're evil. I think that they're just optimizing. For engagement. But that has the side effect of creating this kind of cesspool. But I think it's just weaponized something that's always been around with social networks.
I would say this. I've had death threats on pretty much every social network that exists. Never Pinterest.
Never Pinterest.
But you know what? If you did get death threats on Pinterest, they'd be the most beautifully designed.
They'd have kitty cats. Right. Yeah. They'd be cats.
They would involved. Be just exquisite.
Yeah. I think it's worth noting that Pinterest was designed with a lot of women on the engineering team. And they did design. Now, granted, you
were
can't
they,
really
though?
Yeah, definitely.
I just read Emily Chang's book, Brotopia, which was wonderful. Everyone in tech should read that book. She talks about the leadership being almost entirely male, and they had one of the worst bro cultures there, and they cynically marketed to a female demographic. But I don't know anything about the engineering team.
I might be conflating Pinterest and Instagram. I admit that. But it was
company, yeah.
Maybe I'm misremembering. But
Instagram, though, is pretty good. It has somewhat degenerated, but it's still pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Maybe it's pictures that are okay, because it's hard to threaten death with pictures. Maybe
we all joke about
challenge people, but
we joke about how Facebook is now where your mom hangs out. But I think about how my mom engages with Facebook, and it's pretty positive. It's a pretty positive experience for her.
Yeah.
I'm sure she sees a lot of political stuff, as do everybody on Facebook. But what my mom gets out of the experience of logging into Facebook is almost entirely positive. She's connected with her kids and grandkids. She's connected with her high school friends. She lives in a world of connection that just wouldn't have been possible for her in any other way, really. And so there is some positive stuff, obviously, that is enabled by these platforms. And maybe it's – I don't know. I don't know if it's the platform or if it's human beings that are misaligned here.
You're probably right. It's us.
It's so funny because this is probably the fourth tweet in a row that without inadvertently has ended up being this conversation. I think it's something that it's really on people's minds right now.
There's a reckoning coming. There's a reckoning with all this stuff. I mean, we're seeing the beginnings of it with, Zuckerberg testifying and stuff like that. But I think there's going to be a cultural reckoning with it very, very soon. And I don't know what that's going to look like or how it'll play out. But I think that everybody is having this conversation, whether it's, pundits like us on shows or just average people in the street, there's a weirdness. I mean, to the point where I'm sure I'm not the only one that noticed every ad during the NBA finals was companies saying,
apologies.
I'm sorry.
I know, it was the apology tour.
Yeah.
It was Uber. It was Facebook. It was Wells Fargo.
Yeah. Everybody, I'm so sorry for what we did.
Except, wait a minute.
I'm so sorry.
Because, and this is perhaps germane, but Facebook wasn't apologizing. They acted as if it happened to them. They said, Facebook was this wonderful place, and then something happened, as if they had nothing to do with it.
We're so sorry you got upset.
Yeah. Something happened. We got caught. We're going to interview on June 29th, Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a great academic, covers all this stuff. And his new book is Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. This is an example of the drumbeat that you're seeing from so many sources now. And it's not just, I have to say, it's not just Facebook, it's social. But how about gaming? Let's talk about gaming, because that's what we're here for.
This was a good E3, everybody. This was a really good year.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, a good E3. Has it finally happened? This was the first E3 that I know of that regular people could come to, right? Was that made it so good? They sold tickets. But first, a word from our sponsor. And actually, this is a great company that I'm a big fan of, and I have on my iPad. It's one of the first things I install when I get a new iPad is Texture. And I was so pleased when I saw Apple bought them. I think that's going to mean very good things for Texture. Texture is basically Netflix for magazine. The magazine app. It offers unlimited access to more than 200 of the best magazines all in one place. You get complete issues, every page on the newsstand, plus back issues, plus bonus features you don't get on a printed magazine, like video. Anytime, anywhere, it's all in one app. You'll stay connected to the biggest and best stories today with Texture from the best magazine. I mean, just look at them. Time and People and Esquire, Good Housekeeping and Forbes and Sports Illustrated. You like your gossip, you got your entertainment magazine, your People, your Maxim. You like travel, Travel and Leisure. You like show business, Variety. I would never subscribe to Variety, but I love reading Variety and Billboard and Ad Age. That's one of the things that's great. It's a lot of these magazines you might not subscribe to, but having an article in one of them, if you like, you know, tech, they got CNET, they got Macworld, PC Magazine, Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, Wired Magazine. You like audio, sound, and vision. And the curated sections mean there's always something great to read. I would say that every week there's something great in The New Yorker, every month something great in Vanity Fair or Rolling Stone. And I want to read those, but I don't want to have all that clutter on my coffee table. I don't want to pay an arm and a leg to subscribe to 20 magazines. So one $10 subscription and I get them all. Texture is the magazine app with no coffee table clutter. Look at all this great stuff. Beautiful, too, images. When you, if you're a photographer, you'll love the photography magazines like National Geographic because you can zoom in on the images. You can pixel peep to your heart's content. And they look so much, they look like the originals. They probably are the originals, so much better than anything in a print magazine. Go to texture.com/twit and try it free. 7 days, 1 week free. Texture, TEXTURE.com/twit. Why wait to start reading the latest issues of your favorite magazines when you can try it free today? Texture.com/twit. And if you're traveling, if you're taking a summer vacation, you're looking for something to bring to the beach, bring your iPad or your phone and Texture. Texture.com/twit. Brianna, you probably didn't have the luxury to go to E3 this year, so you followed it from afar.
I sure wish. Wow.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
Yeah. But Jeff, you were there.
I was. Yes, indeed.
Great fun. Why? Wait, you agree with Brianna. It was the best yet. A really good E3.
I don't know if I would say best yet. I think it was a solid year. It's an interesting, we're in a sort of weird transition state for E3 because many of the big publishers are pulling out or having satellite shows that are concurrent with E3 but not actually part of E3. And so the big crazy floor chaos that used to be what defined E3 has subsided a bit, and the floor itself is still cacophonous and intense and has a lot of companies, but fewer than it used to. I mean, EA does its own event now in Hollywood instead of downtown Los Angeles. Microsoft this year pulled out and had an event that was adjacent at their
Microsoft
theater. Isn't
that funny? I thought they were at E3 because they had the press conference, just like always.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, the Microsoft sponsors the theater at LA Live now, so it is adjacent to the convention center, but it wasn't actually part of E3, and their floor presence on the show floor of E3 was non-existent because they had their own location now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's in a really interesting state. And of course, Nintendo for years has done what they call Nintendo Direct, which is not an actual press conference. There are no human beings in an auditorium listening to someone on a stage. They have a pre-recorded, edited, composed presentation that they just live stream whenever they feel like it. And they do that at E3, but they do it multiple times during the year. And I think you're going to see many companies moving to, away from E3 and moving to that model because it they have control over the message. They don't have to deal with pesky human beings. And, you know, they're able to cut out the middlemen. And why, you know, as you keep saying on this show many times, I've heard, you know, disintermediate. There's no reason to have press between you and your message anymore.
That's what's killed, or not killed, but certainly caused problems for trade shows in general. I mean, Microsoft pulled out at CES. Comdex has disappeared. Apple showed the way. Apple doesn't go to these events. You just have your own events, and you get more attention. You're not competing with anybody else. Somehow, though, it seems like Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo still feel like they have to be somewhere around E3. That's still the week, right?
It's the week that
all the news is coming out, right? Like, and, you know, from a gamer's perspective, you don't really care if Nintendo's announcing Smash, like, as part of E3 or, like, with the Nintendo Direct. I just care the new Smash is coming out. So I really hear what you're saying, Jeff, but, like, they've struggled with this for years. You know, Leo, you were saying this was the first E3 that was open to the press. If I'm remembering this correctly, they tried that a few years ago. Letting people in, then they shut it off to journalists again and let people back in, if I'm remembering that correctly. I just think ultimately it matters, like, what games were announced and what games are coming out, because they're all kind of competing for that mind share. Like, is Fallout 77 going to be the big game that people care about? Is Anthem? And I think what we saw this year were some fresh new IPs really getting a lot of attention from people.
Yeah. I think, according to GameSpot, E3 opens to the public for the first time ever. 15,000 tickets. That was last year. Okay, there you go. So it is the second year in a row. Okay,
second year, and this year was the first time they had different hours for the public and the press, which was kind of nice. We got a couple of hours at the beginning to go in and just have press only. But I agree with you, Brianna. I think you're right. I think it ultimately comes down to what games were shown, what things were talked about. Because it is the biggest week in the gaming calendar, and that's really the most important thing. It is interesting how the show is changing and I think kind of receding in a certain sense. But from a gaming standpoint, from just what was announced, it really was a strong year for some exciting stuff. We did get a lot of sequels, as we always do, but some exciting new stuff, some interesting trends. Go ahead.
You know, and just I too am a gamer, although I suck at games. It's a huge part. It is explicitly my hobby. Like, I'm not working if I'm playing games. And it's been fascinating to watch games both pioneer some of the spaces that we've talked about, specifically social hooks. I mean, in social mechanics, they figured out long before social media, cybersecurity and cyber defense the game industry had to pioneer these things. They're now kind of following the SaaS model, and it's interesting to see the games industry take a page out of the services book and really transition. Almost every major publisher has transitioned from releasing standalone products and single-player products over the last decade to these always-on service models. Gamers, I know, are very vocal with their opinions, especially on Reddit. But whether you love this or hate this, it really has represented this kind of massive sea change that's happened in a multi-billion-dollar industry that the mainstream media has kind of turned a blind eye to.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say this is very true, and it's one of the big trends coming out of the show that I noted as well, that the sort of destinyification of game. Destiny was a game a few years ago that was this always-on service that Bungie did for Activision and has been a big success for them. And it just seems like in the wake of that, we're now seeing the games that follow suit. Anthem, Fallout 76 is Fallout Destiny-ified. And really only Sony is the big publisher that's still front and center with single-player playable offline games. I mean, their slate this year was Ghost of Tsushima, Spider-Man, Last of Us 2, Death Stranding. Those were the big four that they showed. Days Gone was another one. All single-player, narrative-driven experiences, traditional, what we think of as big AAA video games. But everybody else is focused on much more games as service, perpetual, always updated We can sell you one thing, then we can sell you it 100 more times with cosmetics and with DLC content coming down the line. And you're seeing that over and over and over again of these looter shooters, as they call them, where you know you get a bunch of loot and you're shooting stuff. Many games dominated E3, big AAA games that are Red doing Dead. That and looking to make that kind of money.
Yeah.
Think about Red Dead as this crazy hybrid of, I mean, Take-Two made bank on the social mechanics of, in this nickel and diming of Grand Theft Auto 5, and they also have a linear single person story, and they're took what they learned from that and are applying it to Red Dead Redemption, which is right now at least a PlayStation exclusive, so a Sony exclusive. It is a single-player game with all of this massive multiplayer stuff attached to it.
Red Dead
so
is not an exclusive.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
Red
not?
Red Dead is multi-platform.
It's going to be Xbox as well as PlayStation.
Yeah.
And is it? I stand corrected. Interesting. Yeah. Does Xbox still exist?
Hey! That's the only reason I know it's going to be on Xbox, because I have one.
Gears of War is going to be, I mean, that's obviously a Microsoft exclusive. I think this is a really concerning trend for the industry. And I do understand, because being a game developer, I want to tell you, like, developing games is more expensive than I think people understand.
It's
like,
really really Hollywood movie level at this
point. It really is. Every one of these games we're talking about, they cost over $100 million to make. Every time I add a character to one of my games, that's going to cost me $20,000 to model the character and get a rig and a texture job and all of that.
And by the way, that's where Jeff Cannata shines as president.
Yes, exactly.
Did you model Jeff Cannata for the president, or just use his
voice?
We
didn't. He was just over the intercom for a bunch
what
of...
What games. Game was that?
Yes. Revolution 60 was the last one I shipped. But I want to say I was so frustrated to see this trend fall to the king of single-player experiences, BioWare. Like, no one out there that loves BioWare titles, loves Mass Effect, loves Dragon Age, none of us buy those games because we like Destiny shooters. And it was so frustrating to see, BioWare's next big IP, Anthem, just basically be a BioWare version of Destiny, which, by the way, has the worst story of any game that's ever shipped in our industry. And it's a really, I understand the finances of it, because if you get someone keeping your game for a long time and interacting with your game for a long time, they're not going to sell that game back. They're going to keep doing in-app purchases. I understand it, but I don't feel like I'm the only person that, when I play games at the end of the day, a lot of the time I don't want to be social. I just want to kind of go into my own world and recharge. So,
Citizen for a second?
All right, go ahead. I feel out here. I don't know any of this stuff.
Sorry.
No, this is good for me. This is good for me.
I mean, this is fascinating, and it's fascinating as a
thought it was pretty hip because I played Fortnite once, so I'm...
that's the hippest you can be, Leo.
I know. Yeah. I'm in it. I'm with the cool kids. Fortnite, actually, it's funny because it is an MMORPG, but I guess. I mean, it's
not really. No,
it's a battle royale.
Battle royale.
But it's a massively multiplayer game, and massively with 100 people. It's a multiplayer game. All right. It's online. But I get killed almost instantly, but I still watch the rest of the game. It's actually, I think it's doing well for esports for that reason. It's a fun game to watch, which is an interesting thing. Go ahead.
$100 million investment from Epic to make it an esport. That's pretty big, too.
Yeah.
Well, but that's a game that made $270 million in April.
And they're making $1.5 million a day on iOS alone.
And it's a free game.
Yeah, this is what baffles me, but go ahead. Continue on with your thought, Dan. I'm sorry.
No, what Fortnite. Game did you fascinating.
Want me to, what ga- yeah, we'll get to Fortnite. What game did you want me to show here? Because I'm still showing Anthem. So
what's fascinating, Jeff and Brianna, I'm sure that you're familiar with the story here. Star Citizen has raised well over $180 million in crowdfunding starting in 2012. And there is no product. You can download something that's extraordinarily kludgy at best, and they sell virtual ships for $27,000.
What? There's not even a game yet.
Yes. So what's fascinating is the fallacy of sunk cost, and this games as a business model where the business model is vaporware.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really wild. Although I seem to remember Duke Nukem Forever taking a while to come out.
So that's true.
Yeah. There ain't nothing really new in that. But
Star Citizen is a unique case, though. Yeah. I don't know if there's anything else quite like it. There's a lot of failed Kickstarters and a lot of early access games that are sort of meandering, but there's nothing on the scale of Star Citizen. So I think it's an interesting thing to watch because will it ever be anything? Is a great question, but certainly there have been lawsuits. There are ongoing litigation.
So I can for $45, I can buy the Mustang Alpha spaceship.
I think there's a $20,000 pack where you can get almost all of the ships.
Okay,
so,
27.
You know,
27. Yeah,
Alpha. Kind of money, you shouldn't expect all of the ships.
It's an Alpha version 3. Is that correct? Can you play a game?
There are modules, so there's different modules available for it now. It's kind of broken up into parts, and they say that those modules will all come together to be a cohesive game. There's sort of a first-person shooter, human being in space shooting things. There's a spaceship, ship-to-ship combat situation, and then there's sort of a trading intergalactic layer. So all those modules are playable now if you give them money, but none of them
playable.
Yeah, I mean,
Have you downloaded it and tried?
Yeah, no, I haven't, but I know several people that are very invested in the game. I'm waiting for it to be a thing before I give it a shot.
Well,
but yeah,
this is what's interesting to me. So, Brianna, you're as the developer here, you're saying $100 million to make a game. Unless you're EA or you've got somebody like that behind you, this may be the only route you could make A-list game, right, is to crowdfund it, and it's gonna be slow. How do you address this with your company?
Well, I mean, for us, we took the Apple approach that we just kept our heads down and didn't release anything until it was perfect. Like at One PAX East, we got a lot of really negative feedback and about combat being too slow. And we took it, we massively redid all of our scenes and made huge changes to it. We personally didn't ship games until it was ready. That's always been my motto. There are a lot of people, I personally hate this trend of releasing games like while they're still in development. I think for Nintendo, releasing a game to make sure the network has cohesion, like with Splatoon, that makes sense to me because, we all remember Ultima Online when that shipped, it was just impossible to log on for days. Avoiding that makes sense to me. I personally don't like this. And I think it really takes away the magic of turning on a game and just having an experience that's already ready for you.
But how do you raise the money then to do this? How do you finance it?
That's an open question in the game industry, right? Like, I would have to say for anyone, Jeff, you're a huge VR proponent. I love reading your stuff on Twitter about that. But as far as being a good venture capital bet, venture capital funding, independent funding for VR has really, really severely dried up in the last year because it's just not possible to make money from it. That's pressure that our whole industry is feeling.
Well, that's interesting because you haven't seen a lot of great VR titles. There was a burst when the Oculus Rift and the Vive came out, and it seemed to be kind of moribund, to be frank.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of Oculus Go?
We were just playing with it yesterday. I was very impressed. I think for $200, it's a standalone VR. It's actually not bad. I have a Rift and a Vive, and the Go is, not bad. It's missing some of the motion components. But I think it's going to be a way to introduce people to it. But I wonder if there's a market. Jeff, do you think there's a market? Do you think people are going to run out and buy VR headsets? Or have people already I feel like they've decided already, and they've decided against it.
I think a lot of people have, and I think they are going to end up changing their mind, just like people did with smartphones and whatever. I think my kid, who is about to turn 2, will think it's weird that I played games on a 2D flat surface. I think he will think it's weird. And so we're just in early days, and I think once Apple enters this market, which they will, everybody will change their tune. I really believe that.
Wow.
VR
I completely disagree with you, but I'm not an expert, so I'm going to have to listen to what you say, but I feel like VR is dead.
I think it is not dead. I mean, Sony showed a pretty strong library of new VR stuff. They're committed to PSVR. PSVR is selling really well. They announced another price drop.
I thought Sony didn't announce anything in PSVR.
Their press conference didn't feature it, but they had a whole week running up to it where they announced Tetris in VR, Leo. It's called Tetris Effect.
The world is waiting for...
it's actually really cool.
Conversely, is the Switch the future if it's not VR? And is there Switch 2 coming? I mean, is it like low-tech, high-tech?
The Switch has done very well, but I wonder if these new streaming solutions, you know, Sony has Gaikai, but Microsoft says, yeah, we're working on a streaming solution. And EA has one that says, they said anybody who can run Netflix will be able to run our high-quality gaming on any device that can run Netflix. I wonder if that might not be.
Yeah. It's pretty clear that that's a big push in where the industry is going as well. And we're still a couple of years away from that, it seems. Everybody's talking about it, but the infrastructure doesn't seem to be in place yet. And Microsoft is like, we definitely have this. It's coming.
Yeah.
And EA is like, we definitely have this. Yeah. It's coming, but nobody's ready to roll it out.
But look what happened to OnLive and Gaikai. I mean, there are some.
Yeah, and I think everybody's a little nervous about that precedent. And so I think when they do it, they'll want to do it right. And I think that will be a big difference. Instead of, you know, having to spend $300, $400, $500 to buy your new box that you put in your house, that you will pay a monthly fee and you'll be able to play these big AAA games on any device you have.
I do the Xbox Game Pass, which is basically for the cost of one or two games a year. I get, I did it when Sea of Thieves came out on it, just because, and I'm glad I did, by the way, because it was a terrible game, but
so now you're paying for it every month.
Now I'm paying for it every month, so that's a good thing. But if they put the debut titles out on a day and date of the release, that's going to be a very good way to go.
And they are, Microsoft had a big showing for Game Pass, and it's their $10 a month service where every first party title in Microsoft stable will be day and date on that, and a rotating extra 100 games that you get. And you can download and play. But again, these aren't streaming, right? These are, you download them to your service.
Yeah, no, they're real games.
Right. They announced a new thing called Fast Start, where it actually will, you can download, you can start playing it faster than you would normally because it's using AI
algorithms. It's kind of like Spotify for gaming. You get the game, but if you stop paying, you lose it immediately.
Yeah. Correct.
It's clear, though, that what's really happening is that people are looking at mobile and saying, look, all the gaming's going to casual mobile. So we've got to somehow respond to that. And that's what these streaming solutions are, obviously.
I think what you're seeing is that just like with films, people want to watch them on everything, want to play them on everything.
Maybe that's
so
it, yeah.
It's not that it's all going to mobile. It's that we also want it to be on mobile. So sometimes you watch a movie at home on your big screen, and sometimes you watch it, you know, on the train on your – people still take trains, right? On your on your phone.
Yeah.
So the idea here is that you disconnect the experience with the device that you're watching it on, and it can just be on everything all the time. And you're already seeing that with Fortnite, which was just announced and released on Switch at E3, but it's also available on mobile, and it's also available on all these other platforms.
It does very well on mobile, too.
And those are bespoke titles, right? You have to actually get each one, and at a certain point, that will not be the case. You'll just buy the game, and then whatever device you want to put it on, it'll work.
Sorry,
but
Brianna.
I mean,
go ahead.
That also has a very specific art style for it. Like, I look at Fortnite; it's a beautiful game. It's well animated, but I see there's now, you know, subsurface scattering shading on the skin. It's not a particularly technically complex game, which is why they can throw it on the Switch.
But it beat PUBG.
There it is.
Right?
Yeah.
PUBG's frame rates were so bad because it was all of that.
Absolutely.
People chose Fortnite.
The idea here being that and with a streaming service like Netflix, all the rendering will be done on big, beefy computers in the cloud, and you'll just get the image sent to your phone. So your phone really won't have to do all the heavy lifting of rendering the graphics or even any of the AI processing, any of it. The game will all be handled remotely, and you'll just be getting the frames sent to you.
You'll have IoT downstream unit.
Right.
Street Fighter 30th Edition came out this week. I've played a lot of Street Fighter. I've spent 30 years working on my theater, on my Street Fighter skills. And, you know, I won't even play with the wireless controller for Street Fighter because that gives that little bit of lag and inputs for playing people competitively. If you're talking about like then the round trip between a server center and your computer and the lag on top of that, because so many of these games are competitive, Gears of War, you know, PUBG, you know, Fortnite, I am unsold on this being the future. We try it with OnLive. You know, Sony has been offering this for years. If I remember correctly, they bought all the patents for OnLive, Sony did, and then tried to turn it into, we're going to sell the entire PS2 catalog. When you play those games, they're blurry, there's lag, the DLC doesn't work correctly. I'm not sold on that future.
I'm in your camp as well, Brianna. I'm old enough to want my games rendered locally, but people said the exact same thing about movies. They really did. Yeah. They said, wow, why would I want that? I can get this beautiful version on a disc and it's exquisite and it's lossless and all this stuff. And people don't care.
Yeah. I think that there is the gaming industry, especially over the last decade, has been an industry that in transition where it once catered to gamers who, Brianna, I'm in your camp, especially when it comes to competitive games. I want a lag-free experience. But the market of us versus the market of, like Leo said, mobile or casual gamers, I think that it is orders of magnitude larger, and the industry is looking at the bottom line. And especially because so many of these companies, the publishers are public companies, they're really looking at their bottom line and they're looking at the market and the ability to capture a market that was not previously gamers and didn't think of themselves as gamers. And to transition these people and capture this audience is far easier than it is to, like we've said in this conversation, super serve in a market that's already there that may have very specific niches of things that they want, but there simply is high overhead, low return on that investment. So
yeah,
I think
to underscore that point, sorry.
I was just going to reaffirm what you said. Yeah, the market is just much larger for people who care not about milliseconds of lag.
Yeah, and you know, Leo brought up the fact that Fortnite has overtaken PUBG as far as the battle royale, the global battle royale of choice. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but a very not insignificant one is the fact that Fortnite's free. And I think driving costs down is a huge factor in opening these experiences up. And as I said, if you're having a situation where in order to render a game, you need a $300-$500 box in your house, or heaven forbid, a $1,000-$3,000 PC. You compare that to a device you already have because it's your phone or your whatever, and you don't really care how powerful it is because all of that is handled in the cloud and it's just sent to you. It expands that audience exponentially because people are just able to not have to worry about investing in the device that plays the game.
We used to say that adult content drove technology. I think it's pretty clear that in the last 10 years, that it's actually gaming that has driven
gaming.
Hardware. Yep. It's driven new economic models.
AI.
It's driven the cloud. It's driven AI. And one of the things as an outsider, I mean, I'm a casual gamer, but as an outsider, one of the things that's clear to me is that gaming is an incredibly diverse market. I mean, if you just listen to this conversation, There are initiatives going in a lot of different areas, and I don't think anybody knows if VR is going to be the next big thing or if streaming games are going to be the next big thing or Battle Royale is going to be the next. I mean, Fortnite came out of nowhere. Everybody thought PUBG was going to be the next big thing, and along comes this game that was fairly weak, and they said, well, we could do a Battle Royale and give it away and make all our money in digital goods. It's really, I think it's very difficult to, I don't envy you, Jeff, and people who have to cover gaming, because it is an incredibly diverse field. It's not one thing at all.
No, and you have, increasingly, you have these deeper and deeper niches that are ingrained.
Yeah, people don't care what PC people think, right?
Well, I think it's even more specific than that. It's not really even console versus PC anymore. It's, I'm a League of Legends player.
You're either Overcast or Fortnite, and who cares about the other guy?
Yeah. Exactly.
What happened to League of Legends? Is it still popular?
Oh, hugely. Okay. Yes. but I did a stream recently with that I was hosting with some of the biggest League of Legends streamers, and they were competing. This was a year or so ago, and these guys, the whole gimmick for this stream was that we were going to make them play games that aren't League of Legends, and they just had A, no interest, and B, no knowledge of any.
Right.
They weren't video gamers. They weren't video gamers.
They're League
of Legends
players.
And that's an increasingly strong distinction of people who just play Fortnite or just play whatever that particular game is, because the games are deep enough, the experiences are perpetual enough that they can do that. And the audiences for those things, you can make a living just streaming one particular game and getting very, very deep into it. And the skill set that you need to be a top level player in those fields, precludes you from playing anything else because you have to spend so much time perfecting your skills.
I did watch on Microsoft's Mixer the Fortnite Pro-Am, and I have to say it was quite engaging. Niche, who of course is very well known streamer on Twitch.tv, he's actually streamed with Drake, and DJ Marshmello, who is I'm told. I couldn't figure out why he was wearing that hat, but I'm told is an EDM superstar and YouTube superstar, won $1 million for charity. It was a $3 million purse in this event. That opened my eyes somewhat. You know, that's a lot of money. And I don't
Epic has set aside $100 million over the next year to make Fortnite into an esport. It's a $100 million prize purse that's going to be distributed over multiple events. We don't know how many events yet. We don't know how that money is going to be given out. But $100 million to give away as prizes to entice esports players to play Fortnite. Now, if you look at the next 20 esports, League of Legends, Dota, whatever, any game you want, Counter-Strike, anything, the biggest stuff. And you add up all the prize purses over a year, they don't make $100 million.
Yeah.
The next 20 games. So it is a huge initiative. Fortnite is dominating the world right now. And it will only be more so because casual players and professionals who want to make that money are going to be focusing very intently on this game.
Let me play. This is the last few seconds of the game in Fortnite. I watched the entire Final Battle Royale in its entirety, and I actually really enjoyed it. Let me see if I can get it to play. And no, I can't, unfortunately. But it was as engaging as watching the last few minutes of the Super Bowl or the NBA Finals. It was really engaging. It was really fun. And it kind of turned me around because I thought esports, nobody wants to watch people play. They want to play. But Fortnite has turned me around a little bit. I can see that. By the way, another thing that people are doing apparently is watching the World Cup on PSVR.
Yeah, baby.
Have you tried that?
I haven't yet. I'm anxious to try it. I have
BBC
seen some live
is
events.
Streaming in virtual reality.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're in early days, right? The visual fidelity of these headsets when you watch video is still a little disappointing. You get some graininess. You get some. It's not great, but it's improving with the Vive Pro and the new Samsung headset have higher resolutions, and I think we're going to see that trend continue. And I'm very bullish on VR, have been for a long time. I think that when people try VR, it is a special technology that I think is a completely different kind of way to engage with an interactive experience than anything else. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of energy, as you guys have mentioned, around it when it was launching, and that has waned. And I certainly agree that it has waned. But I think as the technology improves and some of this rough stuff gets ironed out and bigger players get in the game, I think you're going to find in 5-10 years that VR is massive. And AR even more than VR. People distinguish between the two, and I don't.
That's where I disagree with you, Jeff. I do think I think AR is going to be what catches on eventually. Because for me, it's like I would love to see like my Twitter feed or my email or all that stuff. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's something I can use all day long, getting information around me. AR games have huge potential. We have only begun to think about. VR just closes you off so much. It brings up the nausea problem. It brings up the, it limits your gameplay because you have to to have that teleport mechanic because your eyes and your inner ear aren't seeing the same thing. I think when Apple comes out with that product, it's going to be far closer to HoloLens.
Yeah, I think they're doing AR. I wonder if they're doing VR.
Yeah. I use those two terms interchangeably, and I shouldn't. But when I say VR is the future, I mean this
technology. I will grant you augmented reality for sure because it eliminates the nausea problem. You're seeing the real world in addition to overlays. It has uses well beyond gaming, by the way. It has lots of very practical uses. I think AR, we played with another AR headset. How much was that headset yesterday that we played with Dreamworld? It was, I think, $200 or $300, but it was very much like HoloLens, except it had a full field of view. It's very impressive. I think we're coming along with AR. And yeah, I would expect Apple will do it when they can make something that's a little bit more compact than today's VR headset.
I shouldn't conflate the two terms because they are distinct, but I do think that the future is AR with VR capabilities and video games will mostly in the VR space. I think you'll still want this world to go away and a new world to replace it for fun. And I think that that will be the way my kid will experience most of his digital entertainment.
That's going to come down to, I think that's going to come down to quality and somehow solving the nausea factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there definitely will always be a market for, and we've all talked about it we want some sort of escapism at some point. I just think that market is a fraction of what the AR market represents. I have a question for all three of you guys about Microsoft. The HoloLens, I tried that in 2015 and it doesn't seem to have made much.
It hasn't changed since. It's the same.
They just announced HoloLens 2. It doesn't seem to have changed, but Microsoft has. And Microsoft has made some tremendous investments in the last couple of years, especially with their acquisition of LinkedIn, their acquisition of GitHub. And I know, I doubt this will happen, but Brianna and Jeff and Leo too, I'd love your speculation on this. There's been a lot of rumors about Microsoft buying Steam. I don't know that I buy that, but I could see their emphasis, again, not to mock Ballmer with developers, but when we're having conversations about AR especially, and we think about the HoloLens and all of these emerging technologies, IoT, big data, artificial intelligence, I could really see Microsoft buying Steam, not to acquire the game platform, but to ingratiate or buy the next generation of developers who might create content to populate AR systems. What do you guys think about that?
Well, there was a lot of hullabaloo, I don't know, 4-6 months ago, somebody on a very well-known video game website wrote an article speculating that would be a good move for Microsoft. And it turned into this whole thing. It kind of snowballed and it actually affected the stock price of companies. It was pure speculation.
Yeah.
Microsoft at E3, interestingly enough, and did announce 5 new studios that they have acquired to create first party content for their platforms. So they are very much aware of needing to create exclusive content for their platforms, and they didn't have any of that to show, but they did announce these partnerships with some really actually very interesting developers that have made some really cool stuff. But I think the idea of them buying Steam, I think it makes a lot of sense. There doesn't seem to be any indication that they're going to do that, but it would make sense on a certain level because Steam kind of owns the PC market. It kind of owns. But that doesn't get them what they really need, which is content, right?
They bought 3 indie studios, though. They announced that this week.
5. There are 5 new indie studios. Wow. Yeah. And they're really strong studios. Many of them were already working on sort of pseudo first party stuff that would be exclusive to the platform anyway. But some weren't, and I think it shows an understanding that is what differentiates Sony as a platform right now from Microsoft, the PlayStation, is that Sony has really strong exclusive content, and Sony leaned into that very strongly at E3 this year. But as far as acquiring Valve or Steam or some variation of those two entities, Valve basically doesn't make games anymore. They claim that they do, and they have a new card game that's coming out based on
But they're a pipeline for indie developers. And that's when I think about AR and I think about Apple Apple already has a pipeline for indie developers and for major developers. And if we're looking at 2019 at the earliest, maybe 2020 for an Apple AR product, I think, well, how does the rest of the industry compete? And that is with content and developers. So that's one reason I think about acquire Microsoft might want to acquire Valve. But you're absolutely right. This has all been speculative. I just think, what is the pipeline to get content creators to create things? Because we've all had this conversation. VR has failed in large part, not failed, but has stuttered because of the lack of content. And this is something that will or could also kill AR. And so every major tech company has to be thinking about, how do we populate our platforms with content and with talent?
Well, I just feel like I need to say here, I want to take a step back and look at some of our assumptions here. Valve, I would say, increasingly has a toxic reputation with developers.
True.
And a lot of that reason is because rampant harassment of developers goes absolutely unchecked on that platform. Developers get rape threats, get death threats. I've certainly had that on Valve. There was actually some people in the Hatred community. This was a mass murder simulator that came out a few years ago that were actually demanding to put specific women in the game industry into this game to kill as
That's
DLC.
Nice.
For that. So I would say I think there's a cultural shift. I was at Microsoft Build just a few weeks ago, and what I see is a Microsoft that is increasingly fundamentally culturally different than what Valve has evolved into, which is this laissez-faire, anything goes kind of, you know, bonanza marketplace.
And Valve should be ashamed for not taking responsibility after the active shooter game. I don't like to usually get up on a high horse, but they have exploited for profit some of these really horrific, not just language, but threats.
That's sad.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's really sad.
And I think what you're touching on, Brianna, is that people don't think of themselves as gamers because they don't want to make heads explode in a shower of gore.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I
right.
think that's a really interesting point to bring up in regard to E3, because that is the front face of E3.
It's and, not all first person shooters. They need to be careful about that, huh?
And I love a lot of very violent games. I'm not condemning those, with a broad brush. But I do think that for the industry to broaden and to, you know, really take a cultural place that I think it deserves, that will require this kind of event, E3, being more than just what's the next ultra violent thing that we can show people. And I actually believe VR will have a big place in that, because while there's a lot of violent VR stuff, it's also a place for empathy. So
yeah, I think what I worry about in our industry is that the incentives are all upside down. Like, we've seen the loot box structure take over, because what you're talking about, Jeff, like free-to-play games, it brings people in, and then people like me, like, I will buy every loot box that comes out. I've probably spent $300 or $400 on Gears of War 4. You know, the incentives don't really reward a game like Mass Effect as much today, which is a game about war and conflict and about the human cost of war and trauma. Like, it's a really big game with some really ambitious themes. One of my very favorite games of all time is the Danganronpa series, which is essentially just a long visual novel about despair.
Can't wait to play that.
It really foreshadowed Gamergate. Danganronpa came out, and it's at the core, it's about a group of people that love despair and they want to inflict it on the entire world.
Oh my God.
And it's so contagious that they cause the world to turn in on itself. And it's about 16 students trapped in a school trying to murder each other to escape. It's a really powerful story. But that's such a niche. It's a very important game to me, but that's not what our industry is putting out as much as we used to. And that makes me sad, because the financial incentives are just not there.
And I will give Microsoft a lot of credit. This year at E3, on their stage, they gave a very significant amount of time to a very beautiful looking game called Sea of Solitude. That is a game about a little girl on a boat, and it's touted as a game about loneliness. This is a game about loneliness.
Well, The Last of Us was pretty successful for Sony, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And Last of Us 2 had a big, you know, had a big presence here. But again, that's ultra violent and dark. It very mature themes, very, I think, handled very well.
Do you
think
gaming is a secret vice that people don't want to share? They it's I mean,
or
it's
less and less. But
no,
yeah,
it might be. I don't want to admit that I play those games. Do you think that's part of it?
We found, as I'm running for Congress, that I have to say I'm a software engineer and not a game developer because it just there's so many people that get a really negative impression.
And nevertheless, they're playing Candy Crush Saga,
right?
Or whatever it is on their mobile device. That's gaming.
Well, and
although
you know,
I have to say, gamers always say to me, "You're not a gamer because I don't play whatever Call of Duty." I mean, you're not a gamer if you don't play the game that
noob.
I'm a noob. Minecraft. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, that cultural stuff is garbage and needs to end too. And I think it will. I mean, the community is getting more diverse. The games are getting more diverse. And it's a long way to go. Long way to go. But I was encouraged by how many female protagonists were shown at E3.
Good.
You know, it's not
tight pants and busty low cut.
I mean, there was a little of that, but, you know, less and less. And it's baby steps, unfortunately. But, I'm hopeful that I tell you, I've been going to E3 since what, 2004, 2003. And I look around and walking around and I see more females there than I have ever seen. And I think ultimately getting more people like Brianna making games and more diverse kinds of games being made, I think we're getting there, and it's taking longer than it should. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement. But I'm generally pretty optimistic about that.
Let's take a little break. Now we can take a break and come back. It's a great panel. Brianna Wu is here. She's running for Congress in the Massachusetts 8th District. BriannaWu2018.com if you want to support that. And of course, Space Cat Gal and the game developer. I'm sorry, a software developer.
Software engineer.
Software engineer. and always a pleasure to have her on. Dan Patterson from CBS Interactive, always a pleasure too. Senior writer for Tech Republic. Wonderful having you. And Jeff Cannata, I don't know why we don't have you on more often. It seems like we only have you on during E3. We're going to have you on more often. You're great. Jeff Cannata does a couple of other podcasts, including DLC on the 5x5 network and with Devendra Hardwar does Slash Film, my favorite film podcast. It's really a great one.
Thanks.
Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you're buying a house, maybe you're going out and about looking for a new place, or maybe you're refining. The Fed just raised interest rates. That means and says they're probably going to go up again a couple more times this year. Might be a good time to refi. Let me tell you where to go. Quicken Loans. I think a lot of people already go there. It's the number one lender in the country. Not only number one in volume, but number one in customer satisfaction year after year, according to J.D. Power. That says a lot about Quicken Loans. But I love them even more because They've reached out to the geek in all of us and created the first completely online mortgage approval process. You don't have to go get your pants on and go to the bank. You don't have to beg for money. You don't have to fill out a 20-page application. You just fire up your browser. You could do this on your phone. You could do this. It's fast enough. You could do this at an open house and get the loan before you leave. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. RocketMortgage.com/twit and the number 2. You answer a few simple questions. They will get all the information they need from their trusted partners, with your permission, of course. Then they crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credits. And in under 10 minutes, they're going to analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and come back with the ones that are just right for you. You choose the rate, the term, the down payment, and you're approved. Under 10 minutes in most cases. Now, that is sweet. You could go to an open house, look at it, say, let's buy this place. Let's buy it. And be approved. Show the realtor on your phone. We're approved. We're going to make an offer right now. By the way, that's the secret in today's seller market. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. RocketMortgage.com/twit and the number 2. Twit2. They're an equal housing lender. They're licensed in all 50 states. And of course, at MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support all this year. Of the network of this week in tech.
I was going to say, I have an appointment at the bank tomorrow at
11. Don't go to the bank.
Look at a mortgage.
No. Okay, tonight, before you go to the bank, just do the Rocket Mortgage.
We'll give that a look.
At least you'll have numbers that you can say, well, this is what I can get from Quicken Loans. What do you offer?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, that's all a negotiation. So what made this such an exciting E3 for you? You said it was a really good one.
Well, I think our industry has really moved forward. As Jeff was saying, I think we have a lot more women characters this year than we have traditionally. I thought it was really interesting to see how women in the game industry reacted to Cyberpunk 2077.
Oh yeah, we had Jessica Condit from Engadget on yesterday. She said she was so excited. Why is that a great game?
But it's also kind of hyper sexualized in a way that kind of feels like they gave out this statue that's half naked this year.
And oh, Jessica!
I thought it was very interesting to see women in the industry just kind of unanimously being like, "Yeah, you know what, we're good." But overall, like Last of Us 2, that is going to star a lesbian character. I think that's a step forward for our industry. We're finally seeing Kojima put out Death Stranding. He was fired from Konami under some really not great political circumstances. And to see him coming back with one of the most interesting games of the show, I think that's really good. Bloodstained is looking incredible. So, it almost makes me sad that I'm running for Congress because I want to play all these games when they come out. So.
Well, once you get elected, you can do anything you want.
You call that executive time. That's executive time.
Yeah. Yes. No, I'm kidding. Kidding. She's going to work very hard for all of us. No more gaming for the next few years for you, Brianna Wu.
Everybody needs downtime.
Yeah. No, that's true. Actually, in House of Cards, didn't he play Call of Duty? I think he did.
Absolutely.
I thought that was really interesting. Here's this an older guy, vice president, playing Call of Duty. It kind of was in a way a mainstream acknowledgement that people play these games. And again, I think
that's how they announced Monument Valley 2 also was through that show.
That's right.
Monument Valley.
Yeah. I bet you that was a paid deal of some kind. Yeah.
Oh, I'm certain of it.
Yeah. In fact, I saw a couple of mobile games get shown on House of Cards. All right. Well, we can move on from gaming. This was a big week for content in other ways. Net neutrality fell, and almost exactly at the same time, on Monday, a judge ruled that AT&T could merge with Time Warner, and by Friday, it was a done deal. Comcast said, and immediately made a $65 billion bid for 21st Century Fox. They were waiting to see if the AT&T Time Warner merger went through. This is a bad nexus. This is a bunch of... I thought Nilay Patel did a really good job on The Verge. He wrote that the court's decision to let AT&T and Time Warner merge is ridiculously bad.
Yep.
And I think he made a very strong case that the judge seemed to confuse pipes, platforms with content creators. And the judge, I understand the way law is written, says, these are two independent vertical markets. There's no competitive issue here. So there's no reason they shouldn't merge. In fact, he placed no restrictions on their merger. Richard Leon of the U.S. District Court for District of Columbia. I have to say, I've been pointing out that at one time the movie companies owned all the movie theaters, and it was clearly bad. There was no independent movie industry because you couldn't get it shown anywhere. And we, as a nation, decided that that wasn't a good thing, and we broke them up.
Yeah.
This is, to me, exactly the same thing where the companies that distribute content are now owning the companies that make content, and that's going to be bad for the independents.
Yeah. You know, I realize I don't want to comment on Al Franken leaving, the Senate. I think that's a whole thing. But if you read his book, Giant of the Senate, he really talked very eloquently about his fight to end these giant media mergers, about Comcast lying to the Senate in one hearing about some policies about offsetting their costs for lower income people and just completely making that up and not following through on it. I think it's ridiculously anti-competitive. And the way I feel is, when I get to Congress, I'm going to do everything in my power to break these giant companies up.
Good.
And, you know, they just have too much power. If you look at the amount of money they're throwing into the system, it's bad. This is bad for United States innovation. It's bad for cybersecurity. It's bad in every possible way it could be bad, including consumers. And this is only going to get better if you vote people in that care about you more than they care about accepting money from these companies. So something's fundamentally got to change. And America's not going to get better on this path we're on.
Yeah, $600,000 to Michael Cohen. That's a pretty good return on investment.
It should also be noted, and I'll disclose my significant other works in the AG's office, but New York is leading 23 states in the Attorney General Underwood, acting AG Underwood, is protesting this, and it's important to say the states are fighting this because
you're talking about net neutrality.
Net neutrality, yeah. The states have become the front line of defense for all of the reasons that you guys enumerated here, that this is bad for innovation. It's bad for big business, and it's bad for independent business, and it's certainly bad for consumers. And to have the states stand up and say, hey, look, we're a part of the conversation too, is incredibly important because this is yet another roadblock, or at least the states represent a roadblock to this rollback.
It was really no coincidence that on Monday, both net neutrality ended and AT&T got the go-ahead to merge with Time Warner. That's why I would say. Now, Jeff Jarvis says on Twig, and he's, you know, a professional journalism, has a lot of interest in this, that this is really just old companies, old line distribution and media companies, with their last gasp trying to hold on to the old business model. But I have to say, if without net neutrality, when a company like AT&T owns a lot of content and doesn't own other content, there's nothing to stop them from saying, well, we'll give you access to HBO for free, no bandwidth cost, but we're going to charge you if you want to watch Netflix. That seems to me baldly anti-competitive. It hasn't happened yet, but I expect it will. And they'll do it with zero. By the way, they'll do it with zero rating, which is, you know, it's hard to explain to normal people why saving them money is a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't even have to be consumer-facing, at least to start, right? They can just have these shady deals between companies,
right,
and start having to charge Netflix more. And I mean, this all of this stuff is really disheartening and really bad. And I don't know what we can do. You know, I'm hopeful we see Washington State as being a state that seems to be fighting this. California, I understand, is going to.
There's 23 states.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that within the borders of individual states, this stuff will take a hard line and we'll say, hey, we will still enforce net neutrality. But I can't imagine that's going to last. And if it's, I don't know, I feel like this is a very bleak moment for our digital future, to be honest.
But I've said this on Twitter before, and I want to repeat this. You know, this is not as hopeless as people may believe that it is. In the House where I am running for Congress, eight votes run the table on all the technology policy there on a very specific committee. And then in the Senate, it's 15 votes run the table on all of that policy. So we don't have to get everyone in Congress to not take money from Verizon and AT&T. You just need to get enough of us that believe in these issues running for Congress and serving on those committees. You can change privacy. You can change net neutrality. You can get right to repair in there. You can get right to encryption. There are all these issues that we care about. They're so critical for a free republic that we can make a difference with. But it's like, I'm only one of eight votes. I need other people, other engineers, other tech heads to run for office with me. And believe me, I would so much rather be making software right now. But, you know, this is the time where we have to stand up and save our future. So it's inconvenient.
After Twit last Sunday night, Ajit Pai published a op-ed piece, a commentary on CNET, saying, I support a free and open internet. He says, you don't understand that if we don't change these rules, you're not going to get investment in a better and faster internet. You're not going to see the better access that you want. You're not going to see rural internet progress. That it's important to give these companies a free hand so that they do invest in an improved internet.
Please.
Yeah. That's always worse historically.
Please.
Right.
Yeah. You know, rural electrification only came because we mandated it. And it's the exact same with the internet. We can solve that in other ways. We can give tax incentives. There are a thousand other ways to solve that problem that don't involve giving, you know, these telecom companies free reign over information to this degree. So, no, try again.
Yeah. Says this approach will be very positive for consumers. For instance, recently I heard from a rural broadband provider in Vermont, VTEL, they wrote to say regulating broadband like legacy telephone service would not create any incentives for VTEL to invest in its network. It would have the opposite effect. And I'm sure he's heard the same thing from AT&T and Comcast and Verizon.
I don't have any faith that this dude even believes it. You're right. You can feel that in the statement that he doesn't even believe what he's saying. I don't know. I don't want to get angry.
There's
but
also a little bit of a lie that he's repeating that I keep hearing from people who are in favor of scrapping net neutrality, that at the dawn of the internet, Congress and Clinton agreed on a light touch framework. Under that approach, the internet was open and free. Network investment topped $1.5 trillion. Netflix, Facebook, Amazon, and Google went from small startups to global tech giants. I hear this again and again. No, we're just going back to the way it used to be, the unregulated light touch internet. Well, sure. Okay, you can sigh, but you've got to tell me why that's not true.
This is a very predictable argument, right? Like, they always push for lack of regulation. Look at Theranos. Right. You know, that book, Bad Blood, I've read that 4 times.
Isn't
it's
that
absolutely
fascinating?
Jaw-dropping.
Yeah. It's hard to believe it happened.
It's hard to believe.
It's not hard to believe.
Yes.
We cover tech. Come on.
I guess
the only reason anything happened there is because we had basic regulations to protect people's health. And I think in that same way, you know, like this laissez-faire approach to absolutely everything in technology, it's just not always the answer.
It's like saying we didn't have speed limits when cars first came around. So why have speed limits?
Right.
There were no seat belts in a car when the Model T was first introduced. So I don't know why you're so upset that we took all the seat belts out of the car. It's a completely different universe now. It's insulting.
Facebook can say that about the election interference, right? Like, oh, we didn't have this when it first started. And you know, we have to look at systems as they are today. And we don't look at what's best for, you know, AT&T and Verizon. They do business here in America. The question is this better for the American people? It's not. And, you know, I think it's a Texas two-step.
And all of this is, yes, an eye on today, but also an eye on the future. Let's not forget that 5G is coming and coming somewhat fast. And 5G is a disruptive technology like we have not seen in mobile. And if these companies are not able to control it in the way they want, it could fundamentally disrupt the way they operate now.
Actually, the 5G standard for the first time got kind of somewhat ratified. The specifications were finalized this week. I'm not sure, really, and I don't know if anybody is, what 5G means. It seems to mean different things to different people, even different things to different telcos. But I think what we all want is a faster network that can handle more traffic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what 5G promises, even gigabit speeds over wireless broadband. That would be pretty impressive. And it would make – and I guarantee you that's exactly what companies like Microsoft – Sony and EA are looking at when they talk about streaming games. They're looking at the future where
100%, absolutely.
Yeah, you can play Fortnite on your smartphone in the middle of a desert because you've got 5G.
I'm ready for that future.
I am too. I am too.
Actually, in the middle of the desert might be dovetail with the arguments you guys just made a moment ago, which is ruralification. Although people who live in rural areas don't have the same voice that us in urban areas do, 5G could change that.
Well, and that's why I'm wondering, I mean, if you maybe Pi is saying, look, we got these new technologies. And now he is, in fact, saying we've got these new technologies coming along. We want people to invest in these. And we see 5G coming, and we don't feel like if we regulate the hell out of these ISPs, they're gonna be incented to develop things like 5G.
Except they are, obviously.
Because they'll make money.
Yes.
Yep. Right. It's just a question of how much.
As long as they still have competition, they won't. I mean, way we're going, they won't.
Yeah. In fact, that's, it was a green light. The judge's decision was a green light for Comcast to bid against Disney. They're both bidding for 21st Century Fox. Not Fox News, but regional Fox Sports. I don't know. Sky, I think, is part of it. And the other thing that's interesting is Hulu. It would give Comcast a 60% controlling interest in Hulu. And you might say, that really is these companies saying, okay, we've got to recognize that the future is upon us, and we need to be, if we're going to succeed, we can't succeed. Comcast can't succeed as a dumb pipe company. We've got to have some content to sell as well.
Yeah, content is king.
Right.
And controlling content and the ability to create new content based on owned IP is, I think, where everybody realizes their bread is buttered. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this bidding war shakes out.
Yeah, Disney bid $52.4 billion. Now it's their turn to counter if they want or to give up and let Comcast get it. It includes 21st Century Fox Movie Studios, the National Geographic and FX channel, Star TV, Stakes in Sky, and Hulu, as well as the regional sports networks. But Comcast already owns NBC Universal. Which is, a movie company and NBC and MSNBC. It's interesting that two of the three big news, all three big news channels are owned by these massive corporations. Comcast owns MSNBC. AT&T now owns CNN. And Fox is Fox.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much those channels actually are worth, in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Do you think they're going to be disintermediated, to use your word?
Yeah. Your word.
My word, which you used.
I learned about watching you. But yeah, I think that's clearly the trend. And maybe those channels are less channels and more branding. Like, you know what you're getting when you watch an MSNBC or a CNN HGTV, for example. It's not so much the channel as it is a brand that now is valuable.
One of Judge Leon's points, which is a little bizarre, was AT&T can take pieces of CNN, chop it up, and put it on your phone. Won't that be great?
I think that's called Twitter.
I think it's already happened. But okay, Judge, welcome to the 21st
century. Well, I certainly can't speak for executives, but that is a huge component of our strategy at CBS News. If you go to cbsnews.com/live, OTT is a this is 24/7, always on. And OTT is the strategy. It is the brand and the
top. That's
OTT.
Coming to consumers without going over cable or broadcast.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a cable presence. I don't know anything about it, but I know that the live stream, which is a 24/7 live channel, news channel, they care far more about the streaming than a channel that you would select in the old days.
This is another New York story. I don't know if your wife is involved in this, but New York is threatening to revoke Charter's purchase of Time Warner Cable because they made promises, including network construction, that they never completed. And the New York State Public Service Commission ordered Charter to pay $2 million in fines and finish that gosh darn network construction. It really does show you they don't care. They make promises. They don't care. They don't care.
Also shocking.
Shocking. Yep. Shocking, shocking, shocking. I don't know. I just, not a lot of love lost for me for Comcast or AT&T or Verizon or any of these companies. They don't really seem to care that much about consumers. And they, Comcast, for instance, used a throttling system. Remember when they said, bandwidth hogs? Remember those bandwidth hogs?
Yeah.
After 2008, they turned on a bandwidth throttling system to block BitTorrent. They just disabled it. And John Brodkin on Ars Technica says it just proves that the data cap is just a money grab, that there's no network congestion issue. They deployed their network congestion management solution after it was caught throttling BitTorrent traffic. Oh, by the way, that was back when, there was net neutrality regulations. Comcast was throttling BitTorrent, and the FCC said, you can't. Oh, okay. That free and open internet. News of Comcast disabling it came in a company announcement on Monday. Monday was a bad day for the internet. when Ars Technica asked Comcast why it still imposes data caps now that it has no need for a congestion management system, they offered this statement. Our network and consumer devices have evolved to a point that our old system is no longer necessary. It's been inactive for more than a year. Well over 99% of our internet customers are using more modern gateways and modems, so we don't have congestion on individual channels. It's not a problem.
It fixed itself.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I hope, by the way, that Monday was a bad day for the internet is the title of this episode. because it is kind of an evergreen tweet.
Yeah. Every Monday. Yeah. Bad day for the internet.
How does your router even affect what you're downloading? That doesn't even make sense. I'm downloading tons of data.
In their defense, I think Comcast does have, because of DOCSIS 3, more capability to manage the network at the cable modem.
Okay.
So I think that maybe, but you know what thing Comcast has never done? And I've gotten hit by the, 3 months in a row going over your data cap, they start charging you $10 a gigabyte. I can't remember what the price is. $10. Yeah, a terabyte. It can't be that. Must be more than that. Anyway, they don't tell you how they measure it. My measurements never match their measurements, but that doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is their measurement. So there's no appeal as far as I can tell. So I just bought a second Comcast cable modem. And I just got more, bought more Comcast. What else are you going to do? Yeah, what else are you going to do? It looks like what's the pressure is going to be on the content creators like Google, like Netflix, to become ISPs. Wouldn't be a bad outcome. That would encourage competition. I'm a little disappointed, frankly, that Google gave up on its ambitions at fiber.
Yeah.
Didn't they restart that or something?
I don't think so. I don't know.
I think all of us would probably agree more competition in the space would be a very good thing. And, if I'm fortunate enough to be elected, if there are any regulatory hurdles that are stopping them from being able to introduce products in the space, we need to look at that and talk about that.
But that's what AgitPie's doing.
Absolutely. So, no. He says he's doing it.
Yeah.
My point is here, a lot of
this... He's enriching himself. That's what he's doing.
We're not going to get more companies. We're not going to get speed increases if there's no motive to do that. Throughout the United States, it's clear the ISPs are a duopoly. Here in Massachusetts, there are vast parts of the state that do not have broadband, do not have computer science education in schools. It's how on earth, are kids today that are trying to, get an education, go on to work and have productive careers.
Right.
If they don't have broadband internet access at this point, I honestly have no idea what their future is going to be like 20 years down the road if they are as tech illiterate as you would probably be if you grew up with that.
That's the real argument is that access to the internet, tech education is vital for the future of the country.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, Leo. I think that there is clear, demonstrable effect of Google entering that marketplace. And it really is a shame that they seem to have abandoned that plan because it seemed like it worked.
Without competition, Austin, where was it? I forgot.
Kansas City.
You wouldn't see the other companies stepping up and offering gigabit internet. I remember when I think it was Time Warner's CEO said, nobody wants gigabit internet. Nobody wants that. We don't offer it because no one wants it. And then along comes Google offering it at $40, and then suddenly everybody wants it. Oh, yeah, you could get that, yeah. And of course, these companies stepped up. They lowered their prices. Where Google was doing fiber, prices went down, speeds went up. It's a shame that they've just – Atlanta, I guess, lost out because they were the next city. And Google just seems to have backed off completely on it. I don't see any evidence that they're coming back.
Right.
Let's take a little break. Brianna Wu, Vote for You is a Vote for Good. BriannaWu2018.com. Dan Patterson.
We like Wu, or are you going to call? Wu, you going to call?
I like that. Wu, you going to. I'd put Elon sign up for that. Wu, you going to call? When the internet goes down, Wu, you going to call?
Wu, let the laws out? I don't know.
That's Jeff Cannata from 5x5.tv/DLC, downloadable content. Actually, a good name for a podcast.
Yeah. Thanks.
Aren't all podcasts DLC, really? I think so.
If not, they should be.
They ought to be.
Free DLC.
Free DLC. That's right. No loot boxes here, baby.
That's right.
My son has started buying loot boxes, my 15-year-old. It's gambling, right?
Yeah. Seems to be what some legislators are
is
thinking.
Do you buy loot boxes, Jeff?
I have been known to buy a few loot boxes in my time. Yes, indeed.
Says I'm the guy who spent $300 on Simpsons donuts.
So. Yeah, but you knew what you were getting, and it was
that's
donuts.
True. I was getting donuts. You're right. A loot box is random. You don't know what you're going to get, do you?
Right.
Yeah, he spent the other night. He spent $40 on loot boxes.
I think, I feel really strongly like we need to inform consumers of the odds on these loot boxes, because like what I've seen is if you go to a game studio, I will never forget this. I once had somebody that was working on big data analytics sit down and show me all the information they had on the people that were playing their game. And they would actually tailor the return rate on the loot boxes for how much they thought that person would spend. What
that is
I want to see,
the case. Yeah.
Oh. Like I'm an adult and I'm just going to own it. I am the whale that these people look for when they're trying to market these games. I do buy loot boxes. I buy gold. I will do time speed up items. It's a vice of mine. But I think that they need to be upfront with the odds for people. It really worries me how they are marketing these mechanics towards children.
Yes.
Because like I'm over 18. I can make a poor informed choice there. But like a child, it's just a fact that many parents are having kids that are making these purchases on their bank accounts. And it seems very exploitative to me.
Well, it was a teaching moment for us. Because we could explain what gambling is. We could explain how it works.
But it's worse than gambling, Leo, because that's the dirty little secret that Brianna is referring to. It's not a level playing field.
That's
not like
really
walking into
bad.
A casino.
So they like know that he'll spend more money, so we'll give him less.
Yeah.
Yes. That's exactly or vice versa. Or oh my gosh, all my loot boxes are exactly what I was hoping for. I guess I should buy more loot boxes. Oh. And then the more you buy them, the less that happens, and now you're hooked.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm trying to see what game he's spending. It's probably Overwatch. But that's what
Overwatch again, is cosmetic DLC. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cosmetic.
I'm not accusing any specific game company or any specific game of doing that. I just know that that's rampant in the industry.
Yeah.
It is.
Wow. So they're fungible loot boxes. All right. Well, we're learning something here today. Jeff Cannata is also here. I said Jeff Cannata. Dan Patterson, I didn't say, from CBS Interactive, senior writer at Tech Republic. We had a good week this week. Do you want to see a little video we made? We made a fun little video of some of the things that happened this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
And if they let you download Chrome, that's game over. Game over then.
Whoa.
Hey.
I feel like it's already game over.
Oh, kitty. Kitty.
Triangulation.
Don McCaskill is our guest. He is the CEO of SmugMug. SmugMug news got very interesting. You announced you were buying Flickr.
SmugMug is relatively large size. We have billions of photos, but it's dwarfed by Flickr.
Yeah.
That's really exciting for me. Not only is the opportunity exciting, but the challenge is exciting. I get fired up by challenges.
This week in enterprise tech.
Well, folks, it's Padre's last show.
This has actually been the longest assignment I've ever had as a Jesuit. Most of my assignments are 2 to 3 years. This has now run 7. I don't know how to stop. Curtis, any suggestions?
I just know, Padre, that you're going to bring the sort of energy, and wherever you go next, they're going to be fortunate and blessed to have you.
How long they'll leave up a tweet if suddenly Pope Francis says, hey, I always watch Twit every Friday on
Twit.tv. Twit. Tell your boss it's job related.
He's tweeting for the Pope, baby. And there he goes, Father Robert and his shark backpack. Goodbye forever. How many priests have shark backpacks?
It's a pretty small Venn diagram, I guess.
That's very... my backpack.
It's not actually his backpack.
It's not his backpack? Whose is it?
It's Kevin. Kevin really likes
sharks. Oh, Kevin's backpack.
So he was stealing the backpack?
He was stealing. He thought it was a loot crate. He didn't know. He Father Robert will continue to do know-how through, I think, the end of August, and I think he's going to come back one more time. We can't really get rid of him. We keep trying.
Oh.
But he'll come back one more time in August. And then he is, right now he's in Oregon for his tertianship, and then he goes to Rome.
Wow.
To literally work in the technical office at the Vatican.
Wow.
Tough life.
He's building a podcast studio in the Vatican. A really nice one.
That's awesome.
He really
it's got
is.
Like I've met gold leafing.
Oh yeah, it's gonna have. He's. They got this. Some guy, Michael. Somebody is gonna be painting the ceiling. It's gonna be great.
Nice.
It's gonna be great.
I've met a lot of people in my tech career. He is absolutely one of the most fascinating people I've ever met.
He is a gem.
Like,
yeah.
He's such a nice person.
Yeah,
he's
really
such
sweet.
A nice person. Yeah. He makes me want to be a nice person.
Oh,
like, that's how good he is.
Yeah, it doesn't make me want to be a nice person. So I'm immune to his charm now. He's a great guy. We've been very lucky to have him, and I think we'll see more of him. I don't think he's gone for good. Our show today brought to you by Moogsoft. If you're in IT, you know that sometimes it feels like you're in a pachinko parlor. You ever go one of those in Japan, the pachinko parlors? It's so loud. All those alerts and tickets coming in. Bing, 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 bing. It's hard to know. It almost freezes you. It's hard to know what to do first, how to fix the problem. It's just overwhelmed. No mere mortal can analyze all those alerts and respond to all those tickets. That's why you need Moogsoft. Moogsoft takes that pachinko parlor and turns it into a Zen garden of calm and peace by reducing your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. But it doesn't just turn off the alerts. It's an algorithmic IT ops platform that analyzes the incoming alerts. This is such a good use of machine learning. Figures out how they relate, what needs to be acted upon to solve them all. It integrates with all your existing IT tools. You're not disconnecting. You're kind of organizing. Their patented technology correlates events into actionable work items. They call them situations. So you can focus on what matters. Turn off the pachinko machine and really get the job done. Great testimonial from a company called HCL Technologies. You may know them. They do award-winning. They're a global IT managed service provider, and they have an award-winning dry ice platform that integrates Moogsoft AI Ops as the event management layer. According to HCL Technologies, it's helped clients streamline operational workflows, reduce time in the detect to correct life cycle of incident tickets. They literally a 33% reduction in mean time to restore. Means they could support more customers with service quality, keeping operational costs low and efficiency high. Read all about it. Find out if it's right for you. I think it might be if you've got the pachinko parlor in your brain by going to moogsoft.com, MOOGSOFT.com to learn more. You can get a demo there. Reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Wouldn't that be nice? Moogsoft.com. Let's see. Boy, I don't know. I think that's it. I think that's all that happened this week. Actually, I read a story that's a little scary. It was on the front page of TechMeme this week about a Chinese company that has managed to they're a logistics company. I think they're kind of like a JD. What is it called? JD something. They're like an Amazon, a smaller Amazon. They've reduced the size of their workforce to 4 people while sending out something like 200,000 orders a day.
Wow. Automation.
Automation. I think this is what's coming. Now, this is in China. And as we know, the president is very interested in making China great again. So yeah. I'm sure he has a plan. Their Shanghai fulfillment center ships 200,000 orders a day with 4 humans. And by the way, the humans aren't doing any shipping. They're just there to service the robots.
Wow.
JD says its objective is not to eliminate workers, but to get faster and more reliable. And then eliminate workers. No, they say they're going to shift warehouse people to other jobs. But really, come on.
Not our goal. It's just a fun byproduct.
It's just a fun byproduct.
Right.
It's just a fun byproduct.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to a woman yesterday that had a job at an Amazon distribution center right here in my district. And it, you know, just as a matter of like being dangerous and, you know, like having the capacity to hurt people, like you're essentially running all over a football field sized warehouse all day long. I am amenable to the idea that, you know, there are some jobs that maybe robots would be better off doing. I think the problem is, when we look at this trend of our tax base starting to shrink and shrink and shrink, which is why so many smaller communities throughout America don't have functional schools or towns because the tax base is just eroded, I really worry this trend is going to accelerate it. So I agree with Bill Gates, who put out a very thoughtful piece a while back that basically proposed that the robot that takes your job should pay your taxes for you.
That's kind of an interesting.
Yeah.
You know, we've always taxed in this country. We've never taxed production, right? We've only taxed income.
Yep.
So taxing production, you know, I guess that's what a VAT tax really is all about in a way, right? Because value-added taxes in Europe and other countries, in fact, I think we're one of the few developed nations that doesn't have a value-added tax, basically follow the production of the good. And the tax is applied at each stage in production until it gets to the consumer so that you're in effect taxing production. That's, I think, what Bill Gates really is talking about. And maybe he's secretly saying what we need is a VAT tax. Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. He's already $40 billion richer this year. Whew. Compare that to the average Amazon worker who makes $12,000 a year.
Mm. Let's tax that. Yeah, I think we do.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think the good news is if you have four employees, super easy to unionize. You just need to convince three other people, right?
Yeah. I don't know if they have unions in Shanghai. My thinking is it's a worker's paradise, so what do you need unions for?
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm starting to sound like a commie here. I apologize. We'll move
on. Comrade Leo.
Jeff has the right to earn as much money as he can. Amazon's really creating a lot of value. But I do wish he would pay his workers maybe a little bit better.
I agree.
Apple Map was down for several hours. Directions and search not working. I'm just waiting for the stories about people driving off of bridges, never coming home.
Did anyone notice?
No, I didn't. Actually, I saw the story and I immediately went to Apple Maps. But I, you know, I think it was only if you were trying to get directions because Maps was working, but I couldn't get directions. The good news is there's a lot of other mapping applications.
Yeah, and I think now that Waze works with CarPlay, there'll be even fewer people using Apple Maps.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm looking forward to that one.
What if Apple Maps went down and nobody complained? God. That was when I decided to get out of radio. Actually, it wasn't. That was when it was early in my career. I should have read the writing on the wall. I was doing an overnight shift, and I had tapes. I was supposed to run tapes of church services because it was Sunday morning, and I foolishly during the middle of a church service said, "I just lie down and take a little nap," and I woke up and the tapes going. It had run out. God knows how. But the thing that the epiphany for me was that not one line was lit up on the phone. Nobody even noticed.
Yeah.
That's the worst. Yeah. You're doing a job like that and nobody even cares. Nobody's listening. Yeah,
I've had that before with videos that I've uploaded. You know, it's like there's a horrible error that I find an hour after I've uploaded. And I'm like, why didn't anybody get mad?
Nobody noticed.
Yeah. That's sad.
Apparently, Amazon is already automating white-collar jobs as well. If you thought your job was safe because you're, you know, in the front office, no. The company has launched a pilot project called, get this, Hands Off the Wheel. It automates demand forecasting, negotiating prices with vendors, and, of course, because of the Amazon marketplace, vendors can bypass Amazon buyers, sell their wares directly. This has been going on for a couple of years. Algorithms originally could be overridden by humans if they thought there was a mistake, but, you know, it's not really necessary anymore. So now if you want to override the software, you have to justify it. You have to explain. Neil Ackerman, a former Amazon executive, told Bloomberg, computers know what to buy and when to buy, when to offer a deal and when not to. These algorithms take in thousands of inputs and always running smarter than any human. I think we knew this.
Always
smarter than
anyone. My neighbor, swell guy, used to work on Wall Street, and he was one of the quants, one of those vaunted guys who could look at numbers. Really? And I mean, he's a great guy, 10 times smarter than I'll ever be. And I chat with him, and he's like, I'm home all day, algorithm.
Wow. He's done. He quanted himself out of a job.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to get to, right, is a Wall Streetification of everything where that's the price that was negotiated. We don't know why.
Right.
There's two computers talking to each other.
It's easier,
they came to this part.
You don't have to justify it. If Amazon says we'll pay you $1.99, that's that. The computer said so.
Yeah. And our computer responded with that works for us. And I guess it does then.
We're done. We're done here. Yeah. Let's move on.
Soon the games will play themselves.
I'd be interested, Brianna, when you get to Washington. And by the way, yes, we will be there on January 3rd, 2019 for your inauguration when you get sworn in the Congress. I'm looking forward to that, the 118th Congress. When we go, though, I'm not going to bring my cell phone because I guess apparently there are more than 40 stingrays in Washington, many of them outside of embassies, government offices. And it turns out when John Kelly, currently chief of staff at the White House, was serving as the Secretary of Homeland Security, his phone was hacked. BuzzFeed, via FOIA request, found out Kelly wrote in an email that his personal email had been hacked.
Stingrays are no joke.
Yeah. As we discussed, Kelly wrote, my folks are nervous about the emails you send and ask that you no longer include them on any postings. Then there is hacking, which one of my own personal accounts has suffered recently. I do almost everything now by phone or face-to-face. You know, phone's not my...
Yeah.
Politico had reported that Kelly used a compromised smartphone for months.
And there is significant evidence that we've written about and other news outlets have written about that some of these stingrays were Chinese. And this was right before the president met with the North Korean leader last week. These aren't all White House stingrays or U.S. government stingrays. Some of these are from foreign actors. And we are seeing an escalation in foreign cyber war that seems hyperbolic to most consumers. But we inside tech, of course, know that hacking is real, but it is an escalation of hacking, and these are attacks by foreign actors or by surrogates of foreign actors directed at political or high-level business targets with the intent of undermining communications and trust in critical infrastructure. This is very serious.
Yeah, from this picture, I deduce that President Trump is using an iPhone in a Mophie case.
That's a good eye.
Yeah. iPhones are vulnerable to stingray attacks as well. I was in Kiev last year, and the second I touched down at Bystropol Airport, I was attacked by stingrays.
Yeah. And according to Politico, he refuses to update his iPhone because it's too inconvenient.
I hate to ask a rhetorical question, but who the heck is doing his tech?
Well, he says, get out of here.
Same person that's doing his anything.
Get out of here. It's Rudy Giuliani last time I checked. I think Rudy comes in.
He was using "you're fired" as a Twitter password. I'm not joking. He was using "you're fired" all lowercase letters. The hackers in the gray and black hat community had his password for ages. I'm not kidding.
You're fired was his password?
Yeah, all lowercase letters.
That's the first thing you'd guess.
Yeah, well, and it's definitely the first thing a brute force attack would target.
It's using his own catchphrase as his password.
Go to Black Hat. I mean, the InfoSec world has been chattering about this for a year and a half.
According to officials interviewed by Politico, the president uses at least two iPhones. He's supposed to swap them out every month. He hasn't done it in 5 months. It's been 5 months without having the phone checked by security experts. He has two phones, one equipped only with Twitter. and preloaded with a handful of news sites, and the other capable only of making calls. I don't know how that makes it more secure, but anyway. Normally, the president would hand over his White House phone every 30 days to be examined for hacking and other suspicious activities. But according to Politico, Trump says, no, next month.
He doesn't need to worry about hacking. He just straight up says the stuff to the
There's no mystery.
He invites them into the Oval Office.
There's no mystery. Good news, GDPR is killing email marketing to the disappointment of no one. So remember when you got last couple of weeks ago, May 25th was GDPR became law, and the week before that, lots of email. You know, we're changing our privacy policy. Well, turns out a lot of that email was, now GDPR says if somebody bought something from you, you don't have to have their permission to send them email. But if they just showed interest or they signed up for a mailing list, you got to get their express permission. So a lot of those emails were asking you, is it okay if we keep sending you newsletters? But you just ignored them. I just ignored them. So they can't. this is from
it's a great policy.
I love it.
I love that. We need to adopt it here.
A digital marketing agency called Huge, or maybe it's Huge, told CNBC nearly 2 in 5 Americans have completely ignored the emails.
That's all? I would feel like
I would
be
thought
much
it was
higher.
Like 4 out of 5 or 8, yeah. 5 out of 5. But if, according to MailChimp, about 1 in 5 marketing emails get opened, so it's definitely going to cut back.
There is a downside to spam in the GDPR, though, and it should be said that almost everyone I've spoken with, at least in business technology, is very supports the GDPR. But I talked to IBM Security last month, and they said we can expect to see a short spike in spam, in large part because of the Whois database. And then many people in the InfoSec community would use Whois and other similar tools to track down IPs that were spamming. And it was one of the first things you would go to because it was very easy to do. Just blacklist the IP address and use automation to blacklist lots of IP addresses. And it cut down on the amount of spam that we saw over the last half decade or so. And what his name is Caleb Barlow, and he's a GDPR expert at IBM Security. And he said, well, this actually kind of in the very short term, hurts the anti-spam initiative because now without these tools, spammers will move around a lot more freely and use IPs and hack domains to send spam messages.
Well, it's like when you catch a fish, they thrash around a lot before you hit them on the head.
Right? That's a great metaphor. Yeah.
A lot of thrashing going on. We're going to take a little break, come back with our final thoughts, final words. What a great panel. You guys have been fantastic this week. Our show brought to you by LastPass. Now, I probably don't have to tell you about LastPass. I hope I don't. 33,000 businesses, including ours, use LastPass to manage and secure our company's passwords. We started using LastPass when an engineer who no longer works here thought it was really too inconvenient to remember all the passwords to our website and our e-commerce stuff. And so he just made a web page with all the passwords and posted it. And we were a little perturbed when I found out. And that's when we started using LastPass Enterprise. It's the password vault. Secures every password protected entry to your business. If you think about it, you've got passwords all over your business that can make a huge, huge difference if somebody were to get it. 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords. You know, I was just thinking, I think my Twitter password is "you're fired." I better change that. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. From easy onboarding to password autofill to automated security reports, LastPass makes it easy for businesses to take control of passwords and reduce the threat of breach. We have had no problems since we started using it. We require two-factor, which is a big feature of LastPass Enterprise. I really like that. Every employee gets their own secure vault for managing passwords. You have complete control over not only the master passwords, but access to specific devices and location. You can enable password resets. Password sharing is great because you can completely control who has rights to which password. Keeps our data secure. And, of course, everything at LastPass is encrypted with AES 256-bit encryption. Prevents man-in-the-middle attacks. There's a LastPass for everybody. LastPass Premium for personal use. We use LastPass Families at home, and I have for years. LastPass Teams if you're a smaller business for 50 or less, or LastPass Enterprise, which is what we use. In fact, we love LastPass so much, we actually give it as a benefit to employees. When you work here, you get a free copy of LastPass for yourself, right? John, you use it? Karsten, you use it? Now, are you using two-factor? Yes, Karsten. Yes, John. Yes. You guys, A+. Gold stickers for you both. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. I use it. I started using it when Steve Gibson interviewed the founder and looked at all the source code and everything. He got a complete look at LastPass and said, yep, thumbs up. This is it. Steve uses it. I use it. And I have for years. Learn more about LastPass at lastpass.com/twit. This is the way to secure yourself online. LastPass.com/twit and choose the product that's right for you. We use Enterprise. LastPass does not have the problem. I'm really upset that PGP has this week. There was a PGP issue, open PGP issue a couple of weeks ago. And now we've learned that PGP signing has been broken for years. It's a decades-old bug that allows anybody to spoof anybody's signature. I use GNU Privacy Guard to sign all my emails so that you know, A, that I wrote it, and B, that it hasn't been changed since I wrote it. Turns out, not so good. The good news is this flaw, which is CVE-2018-12020, was fixed before it went public. So that's the good news. Word should go out, though, if you're using OpenPGP or GNU Privacy Card, get the update. GPG has been updated in 2.2.8, Enigmail 2.07, GPG Tools 2018.3, Python GNU PG 0.4.3, all fixed.
I feel like that's baked into the name. Like, it's not saying, you know, impenetrable privacy. It's like pretty good.
Pretty
privacy.
Good. It's pretty good. You know, like, did we get? Good. We're trying to get Phil Zimmerman for a triangulation. Did we get him yet? Next week. On Friday. Am I doing the interview?
Yes, 9 a.m.
Oh, I'll see you 9 a.m. on Friday. Phil Zimmerman will be joining us, the creator of PGP. I've interviewed him before, and I think he's got something new he's up to. But honestly, despite these flaws, it is still the right way, I think, to encrypt email, and I use. Jan, did you teach? You were teaching journalists how to work securely and safely in
troubled areas. Yeah, in 2014, I was in Cairo, and we brought a bunch of guys from Sudan who we taught to use PGP.
Explicitly. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
but it's complex, especially with language barriers.
It's very
but,
hard.
That is the standard.
Yeah, and I wish there were an easier, simpler way, and I wish we'd all could use it, but there really isn't. So what was your success rate? Did people figure it out? Were you able to show them?
Well, these were individuals who were from Sudan, and the education level was quite varied. One, I wrote a story about who was a migrant who was stuck in Sudan, and he had to sell a kidney or make bombs for ISIS. So wow. Their situation was not great. But what they did do is understand the fundamental concepts of privacy and privacy of thought, privacy of communication, and why that enhances not just democracy, because we weren't there to teach democracy, but why that enhances their agency and ability to be humans. And if you live in a repressed society, or if you live in any society, when we cannot think and form thoughts privately, when we cannot communicate privately, it suppresses our own ability to act within our society and be change agents.
Yeah, and I honor your attempt to spread the word on that. I think that was really a good thing to do. And these people whose lives are at risk.
Yeah.
Really, really do need to do the best they can to learn this stuff. Another bad thing that happened to the internet on Monday. If you're in Tanzania,
oh, no.
In Tanzania, all bloggers and online forums were told to suspend immediately or face criminal prosecution if they hadn't registered. Back in March, the Tanzanian Communications Regulatory Authority decided to make it compulsory for bloggers and owners of other online forums like YouTube channels to register with the government and pay up to $900 for a license. which is a lot when you consider that the per capita income in Tanzania is slightly below $900 a year. So a number of forums shut down on Monday. Anyone convicted of defying the new regulations faces a fine of $2,200 and imprisonment for a year or both. So just another place where free speech is not encouraged. And if you're in Canada, you might be a little concerned that the random immigration lottery uses an Excel spreadsheet, which is not random because it's a pseudo random number generator. I think this is an example, again, Brianna Wu, of how you can explain to Congress what pseudo means.
We'll bring a whole presentation, you know, between pseudo-random and true random numbers.
Actually, Excel isn't even really good at pseudo-random. In fact, at times it's been so bad the programmers could reverse engineer the results. A team of cryptographers at the University of Haifa were able to predict the numbers Excel would generate by determining the initial values it's working with. You could reverse engineer it. So probably not the best thing for an immigration lottery.
No, it's not.
Yeah. I can, you know, we can get you a good random number generator. Father Robert will build you one.
That'll be great.
Yeah. Oh, and here's some, you know what? People really bash the president, but I think he's got things right. Trump has ordered the government to stop work on the Y2K bug.
What? No, we're all doomed.
We'll perish. Apparently, somehow this. Oh, I'm not a Bloomberg Professional Service subscriber, but I read the story before my subscription ran out. Apparently, this was still encoded in law that when an agency filed a report, they had to explain what their Y2K mitigation strategies were. however, federal workers probably should be worried about 2038 when the Unix time bomb will explode. So maybe we can get a new law. We could be working on that. Let's keep Brianna in Congress through 2038.
I will get right to work on that. You know, it hurts me to say this, but I do think Trump has actually done some good things when it comes to information security. He has really pushed towards moving more government databases onto the cloud. Now, you know, it's a mixed bag.
Is it Trump or Jared? Maybe that's Jared.
This is continuity of policy.
The Trump administration. This is the one good thing I could say about that. And, you know, moving things to the cloud, it does give it's like one central location where it can be attacked. But, you know, sometimes
a little more
if you
modern.
Look at these systems. There's not really any government agency that is responsible for code auditing and making sure that systems are, you know, secure for many areas of the federal government. So I think that's been a step forward.
And I think you said it's continuity of policy, Dan. I think that's accurate as well. These are policies. Yeah.
So having said that, guys, you guys are fantastic. I love you all. I got to scram.
It's 5 o'clock. It's the witching hour. Okay, I was going to talk about Elizabeth Holmes.
I am here for this.
Okay.
I am here for
Bye, Dan. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Take care. Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos, of course, we mentioned it briefly earlier. We had a great triangulation interview with the Wall Street Journal reporter, John Carreyrou. Was that last Friday? Yes. With Megan Maroney about his really good reporting that he did. Really blowing the lid off the Theranos scam. I think we can safely say that was a scam, scammed a lot of money out of investors, but more importantly, maybe out of the U.S. military, out of independent, drugstores. There's some serious fraud that went on, and now criminal charges have been filed against Elizabeth Holmes, the founder and CEO, and her number two executive, Sunny Balwani.
I have to say, you know, we are. It's not our job to determine who is innocent or guilty. You know, that is up for a jury to decide. But I can think of almost no one in America that needs to go in front of a jury and answer for some of these allegations as much as Elizabeth Holmes. I mean, it's stunning. Everything from running blood tests and having no quality control, lying to Safeway, lying to, you know, drugstores, lying to the United States military, marketing a glue robot as a blood test device.
Yeah.
I mean, all this stuff. If you read the book, it's just jaw dropping, page after page. Like, you cannot believe it. And
I don't understand what her end game was.
Like,
what was her plan? Like, this is just kicking the can down the road. What did she think was going to happen?
I think she believed she could keep putting off regulators looking at the science until she actually had a product that worked. And I think she just came to believe all the things she was selling to people. I think it's, you know, it's something for a psychologist to you know, diagnose, not me, but it's, I will say the allegations in the book Bad Blood were beyond concerning.
And there were a lot of individuals who got blood tests were just, you know, plain old wrong.
Yeah.
It certainly seems to me that it was clear to her and them very early on that this was not going to happen.
But you always wonder that when you heard about Bernie Madoff, what did he think was going to happen? Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
I guess that's
how
true.
He was kicking the can down the road for years, decades.
Yeah. That's a good point. Con artists be conning, I guess. It seems to me like there was a pivot point where she decided, no longer am I even attempting to make this real. I'm just trying to survive. Pull the wool over. Pull the wool over people's eyes as long as possible. And I just don't understand. I guess at a certain point you feel cornered and you're just trying to survive. But it is an incredible story that seems unreal.
I have to say this. It is so insulting to me for all the women in tech and engineering that are out there getting it done every day, going unrecognized at game studios and, you know, major companies like Facebook, really talented women, for her to come in and just so comport herself with such recklessness. And there's a part of Bad Blood where she's really caught on the ropes. The press is starting to go after Theranos. And she tries to come forward. She proposes, like, talking about sexual assault in college as a PR strategy to kind of shift the public narrative and claim that these attacks on her are due to sexism and to attack John Kerry for being a sexist. And it is such an incredible disservice to women that are really struggling with this to have someone that from all accounts seems to be a con artist to weaponize that. It's so offensive to me.
100%. Good point. And just one last kind of a public service announcement. I'm probably the last person who remembers Metafilter. Remember Metafilter?
I do, yeah.
They're still around. It was, you know, in the heyday of the early days before Google, it was a great site to go to and find out about stuff long before Reddit or Dig. Unfortunately, they're losing money at $8,000, the rate of $8,000 a month. They've attempted to monetize through ads that did not work. So if you are a Metafilter fan, and I still am, might be worth checking it out and seeing what we can do to help, maybe sponsorships. I don't know. But it may just be the end of an era. These things happen for Metafilter. But it still is a great place to go and read stuff about the internet. Thank you so much for being here, Brianna Wu. I put in a little bit towards your election in the fall. I hope that's not a conflict of interest.
I don't think so.
No.
I mean,
I'm a fan. Yeah. I support you. How many of your donations come from inside the district and how many from outside?
I'm just going to be honest with you. The overwhelming majority of people that support me are tech people because we're talking about the policies that they care about. Yeah. It's very interesting because when I'm running in the district, I talk about wealth inequality and healthcare costs and housing and affordability and mass transportation, which is broken. But, you know, really any politician has to find a base to fundraise from. And for me, because we're raising on issues like privacy and net neutrality and encryption and, you know, all these engineering issues, I sleep so well at night, Leo, because this is stuff that should have a voice,
good.
Right?
I agree. And I'm very glad to support you. And Really, the most important support comes from the voters in the Massachusetts 8th District. You'll have a choice in September. Please, please, whatever your opinion, vote. That's all we – you know, that's to me the big thing. Everybody needs to vote.
Absolutely.
No more sitting on your hands. It does make a difference. Yep. And whoever you're going to vote for, all we ask is vote.
Yep. Agree with that.
Thank you, Brianna. Thank you. Oh, so great to see you again, Jeff Cannata. Congratulations on your second. Your happy Father's Day.
Thank you. Yeah. Happy Father's Day to you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Really, it's great to follow you on Instagram and see the pictures and keep
thanks.
Up with you.
Yeah. It's so fun being here. It's been a while, but I'm
we'll
glad
get you back soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. It's been fun.
I don't know why we labeled you the game guy. You're more than that, obviously.
I like to think I'm more than that as well, but I appreciate it.
/5.tv/DLC and of course /film. That I think Devendra's gonna be on next week.
Right on.
Yeah, the Slash Film podcast is great if you love movies. What is the most recent subject?
We are doing The Incredibles 2 actually tomorrow morning. We'll be recording The Incredibles 2 review.
Have you seen it? Do you like it?
I have. I liked it a lot. Yeah, it's really good.
Smashing box office records, right?
It is. Wow. It is absolutely overperforming.
$180 million for the opening weekend? Wow.
Yeah, it's huge.
Who would have thought the pent-up demand for a sequel to The Incredibles?
15 years it took him to make it.
That is a long time. That was a great movie.
I love that.
Yeah. It was a great
movie.
It's
amazing.
Yeah.
Has it been that long?
I love it.
Yeah, highly recommend people rewatch the first one if they're planning to see the second one, because I'm so glad I did. I rewatched the first one right before seeing it, and it picks up right where the first one leaves off, which is pretty neat.
What do you think the big summer movie will be? Is this it?
I think it's already
Solo?
Infinity War.
Oh, Infinity War. Yeah.
Yeah. Solo kind of underperformed.
Deadpool 2 did pretty well, didn't it?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, Deadpool 2 is doing very well. Yeah.
I guess we're
in
summer.
We still have Jurassic World coming out next week.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
summer is almost here. It arrives Thursday. I hope everybody has a wonderful last few days of spring, and we will see you next summer. Thank you very much for joining us. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. We'd love to have you come by if you're in the Petaluma area, Northern California, up in the wine country of Sonoma County. Just email tickets at twit.tv, and we'll put a chair out for you. You can also watch on the live stream, twit.tv/live. And if you do that, please join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. It would be great to have you in there. But no need to watch live if you don't want to. We'll adhere to your schedule. Just download the on-demand version, audio or video. Everything we do is available at twit.tv. Or find your favorite podcast app and subscribe. That way you'll get it automatically every week. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Doing the Twit.